Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Fourth and final hour, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game on this Wednesday afternoon. Chris Mason, who's going to join us in just a moment, and Bob Costas here in the final hour. Hey, if you're looking for a way to support your teachers before school starts again, you can sign up to sponsor teacher supply bags through Together for Teachers, a citywide campaign from the nonprofit Pencil to support Metro Nashville Public School teachers. Throughout June and July, you can help celebrate over 6,500 teachers in your local community. Learn more about the Together for Teachers campaign at thegamenashville.com. That is our website. Pencil is Nashville's premier nonprofit linking resources to Metro Nashville schools to help students achieve success in school and in life. Chris Mason, former Predators goaltender, Willie's partner in the television booth on Fox Sports Tennessee, is on the line with us. Every Wednesday he chats with us at 1. Chris, if you were playing, I said former, but if you were current and playing, what would your mindset be right now as you're getting ready to get back into a routine, back out on the ice?
I would be ecstatic. I think that all the guys, are just, they want to get back. When you're a hockey player and you're in the middle of the season, especially, and something like this happens, whether your season ends and you're coming back into training or, this situation, you just want to get back, be around the guys, have purpose, just like everybody else. But you want to compete and you want to be back on that ice and doing everything you can to help your team win a hockey game. So I would just be jacked. I'd be the happiest guy in the world right now if I was coming back to play hockey.
You'd be sleeping in your skates?
I would be. Yeah, I'd have my equipment out and working in some new gear or whatever. I'd be ready to go. I'm pumped, as a fan and a broadcaster. I want to do that. I want to do my job. I have the passion for my job, and these guys love what they do. And, that's when you feel your best, when you're on the ice and you're competing, you're in the locker room with the guys, and, you're all working together in a common goal, trying to do something special.
Would there be any apprehension at all in what you're, being off this long and all the unfamiliarity of what you've been doing 3+ months and then getting back into that and everything else that we know that's going on in the world, just safety and everything? Would there be any apprehension at all?
I think obviously maybe at first there would be before you start getting back into it, there'd be, those types of feelings. But that's the one beauty I find in sports and when you're working at something. And, for that short time, your focus is so intense on what you're doing and what you're, the task at hand. I think that all kind of, disappears for that time being. And obviously, after games and practices, you reflect on that stuff and maybe think about it a little bit more. But when you're at the rink around the guys, you have to have that focus and to be able to block everything out, whether it's, what's going on in the world or your own personal problems or, anything, that might be a distraction. And that's the beauty of it. You need to get away from that stuff too. You obviously have to, keep all that stuff in mind and be cognizant of it. But there's also times when you have to just take a mental break and focus on something else and enjoy life. And, that's what hockey is for these guys, and that's what sports is. So I think that that stuff will be probably thought about when they're not at the rink, I imagine.
Yeah, we just played Roman Josi, who just spoke with the media last hour, and so we heard from the captain. You've been very outspoken. We've been out very spoken. A lot of people coming to his defense and getting rewarded for his play. I mean, that should happen, and we'll find out if indeed it does happen. What makes him unique? What makes him a special defenseman in the league?
Well, there's so many things, and, I love to, and we're talking with Skillsy about it because he just geeks out about, Roman Josi. We all do. But there's nobody that in the league, there's no one that plays his position that can single-handedly create the type of offense that he does. His skating ability, the way that his deception with the puck, how fluid he is with it, the way that he gets through the neutral zone. You just see when he gets the puck, defenders, they can't attack him because, you know, his edges are so good that he really keeps them at bay and really, you know, gets them to kind of, you know, move one way, and then he goes the other way and he gets around them. And his vision in the game is really second to none, because it just amazes me so many times when I'm watching him and I see him with the puck and he skates it from the defensive zone. There's not a pass there, so he takes it up and then he goes through the neutral zone. Then he gets in the offensive zone and he's in the corner and he's looking at who to pass to. And then he circles back and then, you know, he either makes a play and, you know, let's say the puck happens to be turned over and all of a sudden I look and Roman Josi's the first guy back. There's just nobody can do that. It's just incredible, the hockey sense and obviously the skill and the skating and just the total package. But there's no one in the league that's quite like him. There's, you know, Thomas Chabot, I would say, in Ottawa, who, you know, we don't see a ton of, I would say, is, you know, maybe a younger version of Roman Josi. He has the ability to do that. But, you know, you combine his offensive skills with his defense, and he's just the total package. He's the best, especially this season. He was, to me, by far the best defenseman in the NHL. And I know that, you know, when I say that, too, and if I go on other, you know, talk shows, you know, obviously people are going to assume that I'm biased. But I'm not taking anything away from all the other awesome, amazing defensemen in the NHL. John Carlson had a Norris-caliber trophy year. He might end up winning the trophy. But to me, this year, bias and having the, you know, the luxury and the opportunity to watch Roman Josi every game, he's by far and away the best. And honestly, I honestly don't really think it's even close.
Wow, you don't think it's even close?
I think
close.
Eye test.
No. Interesting.
I don't either. I think it's very clear-cut. You guys heard me in you just made the list. Fear that I have is I do think it's clear-cut, but I have these pangs of not Darren Pang, but these pangs of anxiety because we've seen
– Wow.
Wow, we saw Shea Weber in that very same
spot.
But I felt like that in, I guess it was 2012 or 2011, with the two seasons where I was sure in my mind, and maybe I wasn't as confident in myself back then about what I was watching. I think I've grown in how I see the game every year, and it's been almost a decade now, but I was sure Shea Weber was going to win one of those two. So you just,
but Willie, a lot of things have changed.
But I do think it's clear.
A lot has changed since then, man. The market is viewed completely different. The Predators, the organization, the city, everything is viewed around the league and by writers and the media so different than back then. True? I mean, come on. We both lived. I mean, it's completely different now.
But my point is the voters all have their own mind, right, and what drives them. And so I don't know. I don't know that he's going to win it, even though I am sure that he is the best defenseman this year.
Yeah, and I agree, too, because I feel like a lot of the hockey media is East heavy. There's, you know, New York and Toronto and in Canada, you know, they're going to get to see John Carlson a lot more. I just hope, and I agree with both of your points, actually, because DMACC, you know, with social media and obviously the NHL hockey packages and all this type of thing, and this market have grown to the point where it is now. I think it's definitely in the mix. But again, you know, it was another one of those things, like the year Pekka won the Vezina Trophy, all the talk, just because of the start that John Carlson got off to, which was incredible. And everyone else, he kind of was, you know, under him. They were secondary, third. You know, you just throw a couple names in there because as far as everybody was concerned at that point, that he was a runaway for the award. And then Jost, you know, went on a major tear, and he's been consistent the whole entire year. And he caught up a little bit in points, and he just, you know, started doing his thing. And so you have to still, I find, change the narrative. And there's a lot of people that do the homework and do watch the games and do pay attention to the deeper analytics and all those types of things, which is awesome. But again, it's tough to knock that narrative down and to have Jost jump up over John Carlson, even though there's been a ton of articles that have stated just what we're saying right now, that, you know, Roman Josi is the clear-cut, should be the clear-cut winner of this award for the season he's having. And, you know, we get to see him every game. They would not have made playoffs without his caliber of year that he had.
You're right.
That's a fact.
You're right to bring that up. And, Willie, I'm glad you kind of brought us to this point. It is East Coast heavy, but also north of here. And, Chris, you're the perfect one to ask because of, you know, being from Red Deer and, you know, talking with so many people up north of here. What has, I mean, just think about time frame, Willie, something 8 to 10 years ago to today. How different are the conversations about Nashville, the Predators, you know, hockey in the South, all that whole narrative? How different is it in your conversations?
Oh, it's night and day.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, when I played here and I would have friends come down from Canada and they'd, you know, at first, before they came down, they'd be like, oh, you know, they're from Red Deer and Calgary and all that, and they've had hockey forever, however long. And they're like, oh, yeah, it'll be fine. We'll catch a hockey game and, you know, whatever, check it out. Kind of just discrediting what the market's going to be like. But after every single one of them, and this is to this day, if no one's been here to watch a hockey game, they're blown away. First of all, you're getting, you know, the team is awesome now. And we had good teams back then too. And then the entertainment value and the energy and the experience and Broadway and just everything about it. And it's just, you know, it used to be the hidden gem, you know, of the NHL for, you know, people to come watch a game. And now that, you know, with the success that the organization has had and the team's had, it just leaps and bounds. And I think social media and access to hockey and, you know, NHL Network and all the media coverage that this city's getting, the All-Star game. I talked to, I don't know how many people at the All-Star game that go to every All-Star game, and they came to Nashville and they said, this is by far and away the best one we've ever been to. We've been to the last 10 in a row. You know, there's people like that. And I think, you know, the secret, it doesn't stay secret very long, just as the city, now everyone's moving here. So it's in the hockey world, it's pretty much the same as the city itself. It's up there with any market. No question.
Mesa, one of the things that has also changed since that time where Shea Weber, I think, was robbed of at least one, if not two, awards, is the wave of analytics and stuff that we now have more in the mainstream that we're all learning about at our own paces. And you've participated in a couple of articles here in The Athletic about, you know, how as broadcasters we're now starting to present this in the right doses. But one of the things that I think is a dynamic, if you watch our broadcasts, that I'm constantly talking about shots and shot attempts. You're taking that in, but you're also pointing out during a game which team is getting the better quality shots, right? What's really a scoring chance? What's a difficult shot for a goaltender to handle? I've been really intrigued, and I shared this with you, the insights of this guy named Steve Valiquette, who's a longtime goalie. He spent most of his career in the minor leagues, did spend some time in the NHL as a backup, but he's got this database now where he's looking at it really from the goaltender's perspective. What are the shots that go in? What are the shot chances that create the most trouble for a goalie? Because sometimes we look at analytics, Mace, and we're not even, like, if you, like, we all argue what is really, we get Skillsy involved in these conversations too, what really is a high danger scoring chance, right? If a shot is taken from a spot on the ice, you're quick to point out a lot of times, well, it's not just where the shot is taken from. If I see it for a half a second and I'm set, I'm going to stop it, even if it's the best shooter in that spot. It's other types of shots that are more dangerous. So it's an ever-evolving process, but to me, it's really intriguing to try to take all this in and try to learn more.
Well, I love talking about this stuff. I've actually talked to Mitch Korn on end when I first retired about trying to come up with some sort of analytical system to grade scoring chances, because just as you said, as some analytics have it, it's a scoring chance is in a zone, in an area. So, you know, the rectangle around the net, around the front of the net, the house area, that's, you know, a high danger scoring chance. Well, what kind of shot was that? Was that a shot that was a loose puck that, you know, a guy had half a second to get it off and the goalie was already standing there? Well, yeah, it's in a scoring area, but is that really a high danger scoring chance? But what about the one that shot from the point that deflects off of one of their players in front of the net and the goalie finds a way to make a save or it goes in the net? That's a high danger scoring chance, in my opinion. Does it come across the center ice and go through three guys to the other side and it's a one-timer for maybe outside, you know, that zone one area, the house area on the far side, but it's in the zone two area? Well, that's a high danger scoring chance. Is it a right-hander coming down the right side with no back pressure? Is it a left-hander that's got more net to shoot at? You know, there's so many different things that I think go into this because, you know, the analytics tell a certain part of the story. It helps tell a bigger part than just the shots because, you know, back in the day when I was growing up, well, you guys got outshot 45 to 25 and you lose, you know, 4-1, whatever the case may be. Well, that doesn't tell the story. That's just a number. It doesn't say that, you know, we went down and shot the puck out from the wing 45 times and the goalie had an easy night. Meanwhile, the guy at the other night was getting deflections, breakaways, two-on-ones. But now they're starting to, and Steve Valiquette, too, I just love what he's doing because it really does help break it down even more. So then you know where you're getting scored on, where you're giving up chances, what kind of the quality of the dot where that shot is, the quality of that shot on net. So I love this stuff, and there's so many layers to it. You know, deflection, screens, how do you do that? Every shot is a completely different scenario. So it doesn't matter if you have five shots in this one area. They're all different. Some may be high in danger. You may have five in the house, and only one of them is a high-danger scoring chance, in my opinion. And you may have, you know, 10 from the outside, and you have half of those are high-danger, just depending on the circumstance. So it's really, you know, it's really something that we could really spend a lot of time talking about. I know I can.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, the analytics, it's clear, continue to evolve, right? And they're trying to refine themselves and get better and better at illustrating what's happening on the ice. One other thing that Valiquette hits on, Mace, I want to hit you with. He talked about how there are goalies that statistically the analytics can show, you know, they're not as effective when the score is close. The best goalies are the ones that they do really, really well when the score is close and it's high-pressure situations too. But that goes to mental toughness. We had a great discussion earlier this week on our show about can you teach mental toughness, or is that something that a goalie just has to have?
I really think you can teach it. I think you're going to need, you know, help and tools just like anything else to be able to do that, whether you have a sports psychologist or something of that nature that's really involved in helping a goalie develop or any athlete develop those type of skills. But I definitely think it's something that's that you can learn. I know for myself, I learned a lot of that just from experience over the course of my career. But I think if, you know, you had access to some training or some coaching early on in your career, youth sports or, you know, that type of thing, I definitely think that's something that you could learn at a young age. I know Carter Hart, I think he's got a sports psych just that he worked with in junior hockey, and you know, you look at him and it looks like nothing fazes the kid, and he's he was a 20-year-old goaltender coming to the NHL. I'd be shaking in my boots if I was 20, you know, going into the NHL. I was at training camp, you know, just playing with these guys that I watched on TV my whole life, and all of a sudden I'm in the dressing room getting ready to go on the ice with these guys. It's intimidating, but I think if you have those tools, and it's training, it's just like training your body, you know, you're training your mind. To be able to handle these situations, to when you're, you know, you let in a bad goal, to be able to process that and get rid of it and move on. Put it behind you, move on. You know, you can worry about that later. But the next shot is the most important thing. And to not let, you know, what just happened 10 seconds ago affect what happens 10 seconds from now. So I definitely think you can learn, and there's a lot of resources out there to be able to do that. It's just a matter if the teams, you know, put money into that, or players go and search that out on their own at a young age with their agents or parents or whatever. And if teams are going to hire those types of coaches and people to help with that that part of the game as well. But I definitely think you can improve on it, no doubt.
Let's save this for next week and talk about, because I'm interested with that answer and how you go about that with kids in youth sports, how you teach that at a much younger age. You're talking about it on a professional level, but let's talk. I'd love to get your thoughts on how do you do that? How do you go about doing that at a younger age? Is that cool?
I can't wait. I'm you know what? My daughter's, she's at a point in her softball career. Well, career, she's 13 years old, but we went through this. We're going through some of those things.
That's where I'm at. Yes, great. But, I've got an 8-year-old, and I know you've got an 8-year-old. So I'd love to. And Willie is 14-year-old. Is that so? We're all trying to figure out the mental part.
I've got a girl, high school goalie in the family. We're all looking into mental toughness, right?
Don't want to leave Evie out. You're right. So let's get into that next week.
I can't wait. That'd be awesome.
Hey, thanks as always. Have a great week. Appreciate it.
Okay. You guys too. Take care.
Chris Mason, that was good. I hated that we had to end there, but we will certainly pick this back up next week with him. When we come back on the other side, you'll hear our conversation with Hall of Fame broadcaster Bob Costas. That's next on Darren, Donick, and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase, we are excited to be joined by Hall of Fame broadcaster Bob Costas. I think the last time we got a chance to catch up with him, my hair was a lot darker. Willie, you had hair. It's been that long. In other words, it's been too long. And he now joins us on the program. Bob, how you doing?
Good. Sorry to hear of all your follicle challenges, but best wishes to you.
Well, luckily mine's still around. It's just a different color than the last time we spoke. You spent, gosh, four decades at NBC. Is it still been weird not being under that umbrella after spending most of your adult life at NBC Sports?
A little bit, because of the relationships. And the way perhaps it could have turned out, and it just got sideways, is that I could have remained in what we charted to begin with, in an emeritus role. That's what I wanted, because I'd done a dozen Olympics, and I had ambivalent feelings after a while about football, as great as the game is in many ways. There were things that should have been looked at to a greater extent journalistically than networks perhaps understandably are willing to do, given their business relationships. And it had been a very long time since NBC had baseball or basketball, which are the two sports that I'm most interested in. So it was time, given the amount of time I'd been there and the circumstances, time for me to move into an emeritus role. And I think I still could have been there under those circumstances, contributing now and then. And when milestones come along, the sort of reunion things or milestone things where they go back with highlight things or historical pieces, I probably could have done that very effectively for them. But things got sideways, and I'm sorry that it did. No hard feelings on my part. And I'm, apart from that, where I really should be, which is at the Major League Baseball Network. The only problem is there's no damn baseball.
Yeah, well, the three of us share the same passion as you do, Bob, for the sport of baseball. We've really enjoyed the growth here in our city, and we hope one day in Nashville, we're an MLB market as well. But if you could walk in, and we've unfortunately had to have the tough discussions here on this show lately of what in the heck are you guys doing? This is such a bad, bad look, and there's going to be a real ripple effect moving forward, no matter what happens, even if you agree on something. But if you walked in the room right now with both sides in there, and I know we really don't do that during these times, everything's through Zoom or whatever, but let's just play pretend on radio. What would you say to these two sides?
I think they've already lost the most important points. If these points were understood, these broad picture points were understood, the particulars would fall into place, which is this is a unique situation. Nothing that happens now has to be looked at as a predicate for the next collective bargaining agreement, which is just around the corner. And our mutual interests are more important than any individual points that may be won or lost at the bargaining table, especially if we stipulate that this is a one-off situation. If the business thrives, then everybody thrives. If the business is damaged, both practically and in terms of reputation, then everybody takes a hit. And you're absolutely right. There's going to be a ripple effect from this. If they had simply said at some point a couple of months ago, we've taken a look at this, and all things considered, with the health issues and with the fact that baseball, unlike other sports, has to play a credible number of games to legitimize its postseason, the records, all the rest of that stuff, we just think there are too many needles to thread here. And so we're going to call off this season right now and try and get everything in order for 2021. People would be disappointed, but there would have been integrity in that position, good faith in that position, and they would have hoped that they could have gotten things done as they should be done in 2021, given time perhaps for a vaccine to come along or perhaps for the virus to recede and for the league to get everything in order to play a full season. That would have been acceptable, disappointing, but acceptable. If they could have come to terms on playing half a season, which was the original idea, and then come back symbolically on the 4th of July and get the jump on basketball, hockey, and football in terms of team sports coming back, they'd have a tremendous opportunity, not just commercially, but in terms of goodwill. Now all that stuff has been turned inside out. No matter what they do at this point, no season, an imposed 48 or 50 games, they've turned a potential positive into a serious negative, and they can't recover from that. It's only a matter of how deep the damage goes.
Yeah, no doubt about it. The last time they had unrest and last time they had a big dark cloud hanging over their sport was the 94 season that was halted. And the 95 season got off to a late start. So they've been actually in a pretty good place for a good while. And here we sit saying the same things that we did a long time ago. Isn't it strange that Donald Vear was in the middle of that and now he's over on the hockey side and the NHL was able to, you know, come out with their return to play. In fact, they were kind of the first ones to jump out there. Why? And we've had people on, Bob, that have said, you know, they're missing the Tom Glavine type in that room. Why do you think there is this disconnect with everything you just laid out there that it feels like they're in their own bubble and they don't really have awareness of what's going on around them?
Yeah, it seems like the best word to sum it all up is myopic. They just can't see the bigger picture, not only in the country, but if you just want to be cynical about it, for their business. They're missing the bigger picture, both in terms of goodwill and how the rest of the country feels in the midst of an unprecedented situation, but also just look at it from the standpoint of the business. You can win, as I said, you can win a few points and walk away from the virtual negotiating table with your chest puffed out. Well, we made that point. We upheld that principle. Well, that's a Pyrrhic victory. If the business takes a serious hit, and it appears that it's going to, who benefits in that circumstance? But there's so much mistrust between the sides. And some of that is handed down generationally. Remember, Tony Clark was a player a generation ago. And going all the way back to Marvin Miller, part of the mantra for the players was, if the owners tell you that today is Tuesday, that's the first time you should doubt it. And the owners have always felt that the players as a group are not mindful of how fortunate they are and how well compensated they are. And some owners are always trying to make back what they lost in the last negotiation, or they perceive what they had lost. So they just don't come to the table with a clean slate. Everyone's looking at it either as a grudge match, not everyone, but too many people, as either a grudge match or some kind of overarching moral issue. It was a moral issue back in the days of Curt Flood and Marvin Miller and the reserve clause and all the rest. Those were matters of principle. Now these should just be business negotiations. Roll up your sleeves, make good business decisions, and in this case, the business has to be mindful of the emotional connection that baseball has always had with the American public, could really use to have that emotional connection reinforced under these circumstances, but they've lost sight of all of it.
Bob Costas on the line with us. We watched the 30 for 30 Sunday night, Long Gone Summer. Let me just ask it this way. How would you handle all these guys, Mark McGwire, who's come clean, Sammy Sosa still is saying, why are you looking at me? He's kind of pulling the Lance Armstrong move. Everybody else was doing it, so why do you keep focusing on me? But how would you treat all the players that we suspect in and under the steroid cloud movie, the Hall of Famers?
Well, you know, the Hall of Fame is subject to the votes of some nearly 500, whatever the number is, baseball writers, not broadcasters. Not other people who might have some connection to the game, but baseball writers. And those people come to it with differing views of history, of how they evaluate stats, and how they evaluate the so-called steroid era. And so far, those who've been convincingly connected to performance-enhancing drugs have not seen the doors to Cooperstown open for them. McGwire and Sosa would have to rely on veterans committees sometime down the road. Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens have a couple years of eligibility left. So I don't know that there's anything that someone could do just by a declaration to change that. I've said many times how I view it. I don't view it as a moral issue. I don't view it as a matter of criminality. What sort of idiot wants to see any of these guys do a perp walk after a Balco-like investigation? And who really believes that just because steroids weren't available in the way they were in the modern era, that all the players that we revere and romanticize in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, none of them, of course, ever would have touched steroids if they were available. Of course, some of them would have, and there's no way to know how many, and there's no way to with good sense, indict every steroid-connected player as a bad person. So to me, the only thing you can say is, and I've said it many times, that to one extent or another, those who clearly were on steroids produced performances that were inauthentic. Look, take Barry Bonds. This is one of the greatest players in baseball history on his natural merits, on the short list of the greatest all-round players in the history of the game, any era, before we ever touched anything more powerful than a protein shake. But nobody, especially somebody who already has a Hall of Fame track record of a dozen or more years in the major leagues, all of a sudden more than doubles their home run rate, goes from one every 15 at-bats to one every 6.5 at-bats. A guy with a lifetime slugging percentage in the mid-550s, as he enters his mid-30s, winds up with a career slugging percentage of 609 and slugs over 800 twice and 799 on another occasion. How are you supposed to view that, along with the change in his body, how are you supposed to view that as authentic? Oh, it's all good. And I've heard people say, well, pitchers juiced, batters juiced, so it was a level playing field and it's all good. Let's, you know, convene a class in Logic 101. If you say that, I guess what you're saying is this. If there was no such thing as steroids, no performance-enhancing drugs at all, then just in a weird 5 or 6 year cluster, Barry Bonds would hit 73, Mark McGwire would hit 70, they'd each hit a home run in every 7 at-bats or less, and Sammy Sosa would hit over 60 home runs 3 times. And it just would have happened in that weird little 5 or 6 year cluster, even if no steroids were available at all. It's all good. You know, I'm not trying to be harsh on these guys. I think Mark McGwire's a terrific guy. And as I've said before, I think McGwire could have been a Hall of Famer in the Harmon Killebrew mold. He himself says he wasn't a great all-round player, but he was a slugger. He sure as heck was. And if he had remained healthy, he probably could have had 50 home run seasons. Maybe if everything came together, he could have hit 60 home runs in a season or 62. But he never could have done what he did with that kind of home run percentage without steroids. And here's something that almost no one notes, and I'll apologize here for this long answer and end after this next couple of sentences. Mark McGwire hit his 62nd home run in 1998 in his 440th at-bat. Roger Maris hit 61 in 590 at-bats. Babe Ruth hit 60, different era, different circumstances, hit 60 in 1927 in 540 at-bats. Anybody who knows the slightest bit about baseball, even with the differences in circumstances from one generation to the next, knows that that's just wildly out of whack.
We're talking to the great Bob Costas here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Excited to be in conversation with him. And Bob, I've watched more than one of your broadcasts on MLB Network and all the creative programming the network has had to do here. I'm curious, do you ever go back when they put these classic games on? Do you find yourself watching yourself, evaluating yourself? How do you take in some of those games, some of those great games we've been watching?
Well, most of the time, I'm not even aware. I'm not looking at the schedule, and they're not necessarily alerting me. So you're channel surfing because we're inside most of the time now. And, whoops, isn't that me? Yeah, I remember that game. But either I haven't heard the broadcast at all, ever, because back then it wasn't as easy. No one was emailing you a Vimeo or something. Either I've never heard them other than when I was doing it in real time, or it's been 20-plus years since I've seen or heard them. And it's also interesting and kind of, without being corny, heartwarming to hear me with Joe Morgan and with Bob Uecker and the games from the 80s with Tony Kubek, because those guys meant so much to my career and to my life. And to be honest, I was better then. I was younger, and you lose a little bit in terms of concentration and whatever it might be. The synapses don't fire quite as quickly. A quarter of a second makes a big difference when the ball leaves the bat. I used to react immediately. Now sometimes I react half a tick less than immediately. And some of that also has to do with the fact that on the MLB Network, it's no fault of theirs. I love being there. But you're parachuting in for single games. The games you're seeing, taken from the archives, are part of series. So you're doing an entire postseason. You're doing the Division Series, the LCS, the World Series in some years. You're around the game all the time. The game of the week on NBC on Saturday afternoons was a different thing. I was around the game more. I was just more familiar with everything. I study now and prepare now as hard as I can, but it was more organic then. Not a complaint, just an observation and an answer to your question. I'd like to think I'm still pretty good. But back then, I think, objectively, I was way better than pretty good.
Well, we still think you're very good. And so,
thank you.
Bob, I could tell, too, just with your love of the game, how much you and Tom Verducci enjoyed putting together the Vin Scully piece, which I enjoyed as a play-by-play announcer myself. I do the Predator games, but I'm an ex-minor league baseball player. But, you know, I just had so many memories looking back and some games before I was old enough to take in how he called the game. So just your thoughts. I mean, I grew up on the game of the week where you're doing a game, Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola are doing a game. You're doing it with Tony mm-hmm. Kubek. Mm-hmm. His influence on you, as you're doing games alongside of him and knowing how much you respect him, what kind of role did he play in making you a better broadcaster?
It's a good question. I've always felt that no matter how much you admire another broadcaster, like every kid I went to Syracuse with just about grew up admiring Marv Albert because so many of them were from the New York area, and we would do the Syracuse basketball games on the campus station. And understandably, 18, 19, 20 years old, they're all copying Marv Albert. But Marv is so distinctive that copying him just makes you seem like a pale imitation. So I've always felt, pardon me, that no matter how much you admire someone, you can take certain things from them, but you should not copy them. What makes them great is that they're distinctive. They're a one and only in their own category. But with Vin, what you can take away is an appreciation for pace and rhythm. He was the master of it. And, of course, games were less cluttered then than they are now. There's so much going on graphically and commercial drop-ins and all kinds of replays and StatCast and strike zone box and everything. It gets in the way of the natural pace and rhythm of a good broadcaster. But you could take your cues from Vin for that, especially for baseball, because baseball at its best has a different rhythm than other sports. And the importance of weaving history and anecdotes in there, but don't do it with the bases loaded and the game on the line. Don't do it with two outs, and then you have to truncate your story and come back and finish it in the next half inning. And preparation. Every good broadcaster, you know it yourself doing the Predators games, every good broadcaster over-prepares. Better off to use only 20 or 30% of what you prepared than to have known too little. You're always looking at that game that's going to go two overtimes or 15 innings with a rain delay, and that's when you have to dip into the bucket. Some of it's specific preparation for that game, but a lot of it is what you've accumulated. It's in the back of your mind over the years, and it just pops to the front of your mind when the circumstance calls for it.
So who is the next piece on? Because it's going to be tough to top Vin, for sure, but as you guys mentioned throughout that broadcast, there's a lot of great baseball voices, and we may have a lot of time to fill on the MLB Network if things go according to plan.
Well, we just did it yesterday. My part and Tom Verducci's part, we just did it yesterday. And now the producers, we already know the components, but they got to jigsaw it together. And it's on Jack Buck, and it will air this coming Monday.
Bob Costas here with us on Darren, Donick, and Chase. And that was actually one of my, you bring up Jack Buck, that was one of my favorite parts of Long Gone Summer because, you know, I'm a little younger than these guys, so I don't remember Jack Buck. I obviously know his son Joe and have grown up with his voice, but that was probably one of my favorite parts is some of the scenes that they showed of Jack Buck and some of his calls during that home run race.
Yeah, and at that point, it's 1998, Jack passed away in 2002, and he had Parkinson's, which not only affected him in terms of the tremors, but it also affected his voice. So younger fans whose impression of Jack is only from those later years don't really have a grasp of how great he was, how phenomenally great he was, not only dramatic with his calls, but he had a sly, dry wit. He had an honest sentimentality, which helped to connect him to the St. Louis fans. And this is true with local broadcasters, not so much network broadcasters. But when you become a fixture in your town or region, people are understanding when you reach your later years. They still want to hear you. Jack Buck was what Cardinal baseball sounded like. And so they made allowances for him. They knew that he was older and that his health was failing, but he was still doing his best. And they wanted his voice to be connected to those big moments as long as he possibly could do it.
Bob, we all enjoyed the Last Dance. And, you know, that was when all of this was going on in quarantine, there wasn't anything on, and the ESPN moved up the Last Dance. So we really enjoyed that. You, of course, mm-hmm. were featured in it and got to live that Jordan era. First, just what did you think of the piece overall? I know there have been a lot of opinions on it of Jordan had a lot of influence, and that, you know, there were some things that maybe they didn't talk about as much because of his influence. But let's start with that. What did you think about it overall?
Oh, I thought it was terrific. Something that epic, there are always going to be differing perspectives. Why didn't they emphasize this more? Why didn't they discuss that? But for what it was, I thought it was tremendous. It had elements of journalism, and it's certainly going to be a piece of history. It doesn't have to be definitive in terms of journalism. Did it touch on a lot of things? Was it interesting? Was it evocative of the era? Was it entertaining? Yeah, all those things. All those things to a 9 or 10 on a 10 scale. So I thought it was really good.
We had some fun, too, with and your call was or we actually played your call of the NBA Finals in 1998. Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone kind of jousting each other on the court. And, of course, they were going to go do the wrestling thing with WCW. Mm-hmm. We actually had Eric Bischoff, the president of WCW, on just after that aired. And he, in so many words, said, yeah, I kind of had a conversation with Dennis of, you know, maybe muck it up a little bit, but just be careful how you do it. And he explained that he had to be careful because of the relationship that Turner Sports had with the NBA and, of course, WCW. But we heard your comments at the time, but just the crossover between wrestling and basketball and what your thoughts really were with that.
I don't think I was wrong in pointing out that Dennis, who is a great and unique player, and I always gave him full credit for that, he has no malice. He has a good heart. But, you know, there was an aspect. He was part of what was emerging of this kind of freak celebrity culture, a Kardashian-type culture. And I think I actually nailed that early on. So I don't regret expressing misgivings about what Rodman represented, this kind of trash culture thing that in part he represented. As a player, he represented a kind of genius. He was a unique player. So I don't regret saying, you know, why Karl Malone and Rodman would want to be involved, especially Malone given his image then in a wrestling event. But where I was wrong, it was the one thing that made me wince when I watched the entire Game 6 from 98. There's no such thing as a perfect broadcast, but that was a damn good broadcast by all three of us, Isaiah and Doug, and the way it was produced and directed. I think we hit on all the points of the game, and we hit on the overarching narrative points about the possible end of Jordan's career and how epic this dynasty was. I think we dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. And the one thing that I would remove from that, I overreacted. I said, they've got to call a flagrant here when they were all tangled up. And obviously they were doing the very thing that you and Bischoff and had talked about and Rodman kind of acknowledged tacitly. They were trying to do a little wrestling thing in the midst of the game. And I looked at it. The action was moving to my right. I glanced to my left. They were still in the backcourt, all tangled up. And I overreacted by flatly declaring they've got to call a flagrant here. And both Doug and Isaiah disagreed. They were right, and I was wrong. So if there was one thing that I'd like to erase from that otherwise very good broadcast, that would be it.
Bob, I know this is where we're supposed to let you go, but I don't know the next.
That's okay. You want to keep going?
Well, I know the next time we have you on, I may not have hair, so I do desperately want to squeeze in one more quick one just about your career, because one thing we've been able to do on this show is we've been doing it from our homes for 3+ months is really have some real candid conversations with some big names in sports. And just because life has slowed down for everybody and we're not all in a rush, and we had Mookie Betts on and he talked about, you
Nashville
know,
guy.
Yes. And David Price is another one, two Nashville guys that we had really interesting conversations about how they got to this point. And when David Price walked into Tim Corbin's office his freshman year at Vanderbilt and said, you know what, I just want to be a regular kid and I just want to go flip burgers at McDonald's, and, you know, how different his life would be. And Mookie Betts told a similar type of story. I know you went to Syracuse. I know this is what you always wanted to do, but was there ever that fork in your road, in your career road, where you were wondering where in the heck is this going?
You know, I was so lucky so early that I never had to ask myself that question until much, much later until recent years when I had to decide, you know, I this has run its course for me at NBC. But early on, I was 21 years old when I got my first job. I was still a senior at Syracuse. I was doing minor league hockey in the old Eastern Hockey League. And I was prepared to start a second season when I was lucky enough to land a job at Jack Buck's station, where he was the sports director at KMOX in St. Louis, which was the gold standard of local radio stations around the country for decades. And I was doing ABA games, the old Spirits of St. Louis. Lasted only two seasons, but it positioned me at KMOX. And since KMOX was an owned and operated CBS station, the network often used some of their very strong roster of sportscasters for assignments. So I got occasional assignments starting in my mid-20s on CBS TV. And Don Olmeyer, who then ran NBC Sports, took note of me and said, hey, you shouldn't be freelancing at CBS. We'll give you a full-time contract. So I'm 27 years old, and I wind up at NBC. And my ambitions then, and the way I saw myself, was as a play-by-play man. Football at that time, a little basketball, and eventually, a dream come true, the game of the week in baseball. But then, Bryant Gumbel left NBC Sports to go to the Today Show. If he had stayed in that position a long, long time, like a Brent Musburger, let's say, I would never have gotten the chance, because Bryant was so good, never would have gotten the chance to host, which is the way I became best known to a lot of people. And they asked me in 1983, I guess, to step in and host the football show, which eventually led to me hosting the Olympics, which led to me hosting the NBA on NBC during that glorious era, all those things. And Dick Ebersol, who ran NBC Sports, at one point said, you know, if you can interview athletes as well as you do, why couldn't you expand that? Would you want to do that? And I was skeptical at first. I wasn't sure I could do it. But he and Brandon Tartikoff, who ran NBC Entertainment then, said, yeah, we're going to create a show for you at 1:30 in the morning. So the lineup then, in the late 80s and into the early 90s, was Johnny Carson, David Letterman, and then me with my dinky little puppet show at 1:30 in the morning. But that turned out to be, in retrospect, one of the best things I've ever done. I did it for 6 years and only stepped aside because there was so much on my plate with basketball and baseball and the Olympics and everything else. But people still remind me about that show. And doing all those things, you know, doing that show, being a regular almost on the Letterman show and later with Leno and whatnot, and showing up on sketches on Saturday Night Live and bits on Cheers and News Radio, which and Frasier, which were NBC sitcoms at that time, that introduced me to a broader audience, as did hosting the Olympics. And it kind of loosened me up and showed a different side of my personality. So if I was to put an era in the time capsule just for me personally, from the late 80s to the early 2000s, and it would include the work that I did at HBO, not only was that good stuff, but it was really true to who I was. It was a good professional and personal amplification of who I was. And then through no fault of anybody's, you know, NBC isn't run for my benefit. They had different things with a different emphasis. You don't go into a pizza place and complain that they don't have sushi. It's not NBC's fault that a lot of those platforms weren't available to me anymore. But I think in the last decade or so at NBC, even though I did a good professional job and there were some high points, it wasn't as consistently in the bullseye for who I was as a broadcaster as the first 20 or 25 years. And hell, if you have a good quarter century, I think you ought to be content with that.
Good stuff. I hope that extra question was worth it. Thank you for your time. We certainly appreciate it. Continue doing great work, and we'll keep watching you on MLB Network. Thank you, Bob. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks a lot for having me on. Bye.
All right. That is Bob Costas, Hall of Fame broadcaster. There you go. Good way to end today's show. Really appreciate all the great guests that joined us. Enjoy the day. Be safe. We want you back with us tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. We'll see you then.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.